Sawbones is a show about medical history, and nothing the hosts say should be taken as medical advice or opinion. It's for fun. Can't you just have fun for an hour and not try to diagnose your mystery boil? We think you've earned it. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy a moment of distraction from that weird growth. You're worth it.
All right. Song is about some books. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Welcome to Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine. I'm your co-host, Justin McElroy.
And I'm Sydney McElroy.
No middle name this time, Sid. I want to get straight into business.
Let's get straight to it.
Okay.
Are you going to get
Usually you're the business.
Well, I am the business. I know.
If we were a mullet as a couple.
Uh-huh. I'd be the front.
You'd be the front and I'd be the back.
Right.
For sure.
So I would be what gets us hired. You'd be what gets us fired.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactamundo. Okay.
That's fair. So, Justin, occasionally it's nice to cover a topic that a lot of people are talking about or hearing about right now. A lot of people probably watched Jimmy Kimmel's
monologue
that he told on either because you watch a show or because you saw it on Facebook, like me, because
it was viral, as they say.
Yes, yes.
And that's kind of internet slang.
Is that what that?
Web professionals, people like me in web media. We say
it also has viral. It also has to do with an infectious disease that is a virus, like that term.
Oh well, that's not my best choice of words. Then, so sorry about that, everyone.
But if you haven't seen it, then Jimmy Kimmel was telling the story, the very touching, moving story of the birth of his child who had a congenital congenital heart defect called tetralogy of Fallot. And a lot of people probably aren't familiar with that, what that means.
I wasn't, certainly.
So I thought, and so did Chantel, one of our listeners who wrote in and suggested this topic. Chantel thought that this would be an interesting thing maybe to talk about.
For something that is so serious, it's certainly a fanciful name, isn't it?
Tetralogy of Fallot?
It seems very fanciful to me.
If you break it down what it means, it's not. Do you know tetralogy, what it's referencing?
Look in my eyes, Sydney. Look into our 11 plus years together.
You don't know.
Do you think I know what it's referencing, Sydney? Okay. Tetra's 5, right?
4.
Oh, this is off to a great start. Excellent work, everyone.
The tetralogy references the four components of it, and Fallot is the person who called it a tetralogy. So there you go. That's the last name, Dr. Fallot.
Got it. Are you spoiling the story for me right now?
No. Okay. No. So, because the first thing I want to tell you is what it is. As if you've watched the video, you may be aware it's a congenital heart defect, meaning it's something that you are born with that is a malformation of the heart. It doesn't come together the way that it traditionally does while you were in utero. It is a complex congenital heart defect, and it occurs in about 1 in 2,000 newborns.
Do you mean complex to mean something clinical or like?
Yeah, it's as opposed to there are some simple heart defects. So some people will say, you may have heard this before, I have a hole in my heart, and there's a little teeny hole in between two of the chambers that may not necessarily ever be clinically significant, may just have been found and is there and may not do anything. This one's more complex.
Okay.
And it is the most common of the complex heart defects. About 10% of congenital heart defects are tetralogy of Fallot. Fairly common. I have seen it. It's common enough that I'm still pretty young, a few years of practice.
Yeah.
I've seen it. So it involves the four things it involves. First of all is a ventricular septal defect. Now, to describe these things, just picture this.
Okay.
The heart has four chambers.
Yes.
Right? We're aware of that.
Yep.
There's two bottom ones, the ventricles, and two top ones.
The aorta.
Nope. Atria.
Okay. All right. I'm doing my best here.
So
excited.
And the basic way the heart works. Do you know how the heart works? Do you know what it does?
Yeah. It's like a big pump.
Uh-huh.
And the bad blood goes in and the good blood comes out.
Okay. What's the bad blood?
Blood that is not oxygenated.
Right. And it goes into
the heart.
Which side?
The right.
Yeah.
Crushed it.
And it from the right side of the heart, it goes to the
left
lungs. And from the lungs, it goes back to the heart.
The heart.
The left side.
The left side of the heart.
Right. Okay. And from the left side of the heart, it gets pumped out through the whole body. Through the aorta, by the way.
Perfect.
Yeah.
I knew that was up in the mix.
So a ventricular septal defect means that there is a hole in between the two ventricles.
Mm-hmm.
So the two ventricles are supposed to be separate. They have a septum between them. Separation, okay. A wall between them. And in this, the first defect is there's a hole there.
So does that mean the old blood can mix with the new blood?
Yes.
Okay.
Then the second part is hypertrophy of the right ventricle. What that means is that the right ventricle gets big and thick. And it's not really supposed to be. The left ventricle is thicker normally because it's got to pump blood to the whole body, right? Well, the right side just has to pump blood into the lungs. Mm-hmm. So it's not as hard. So in this case, the right ventricle is very big and thick.
Okay.
Because it's been working really hard to try to pump blood through the next defect, which is pulmonary stenosis. So the pulmonary artery that comes out of the right side of the heart,
mm-hmm.
just like the aorta does the left side, the pulmonary artery is tight. It's too tight in this condition.
Mm.
So here's this ventricle trying to pump blood through it, and this is really tight, so the ventricle gets all big and beefy trying to pump blood through it.
Okay.
That makes sense?
Yep.
And then the last part is what we call an overriding aorta, meaning that the aorta now is actually getting blood from both ventricles. It's just supposed to get it from the left, but instead it's like crossing over and getting blood from the right side too. And all this is really hard. I know this is hard when you're trying to visualize it. If you look at a picture of the heart, and this is really easy, you can Google a picture of tetralogy of flow and that can kind of help describe it. But if you imagine that what happened to the embryo, what happened developmentally that caused this, is that the division between the pulmonary artery and the aorta just didn't happen in the right place.
Okay.
So it moved too far over, making this tiny little pulmonary branch, making this big, large aorta, this hole between the septums. And the result is that, just like you said, you're not getting enough oxygenated blood, and you're getting blood that isn't properly oxygenated pumped out through the body, and there's blood being shunted from the right side of the heart to the left side of the heart. So it's instead of going through the lungs, it's just being shunted over back and pumped back out into the body. We remember, by the way, we learned a mnemonic for this in med school to remember the four different parts of tetralogy of flow, and it was IHOP. I just thought I'd share that.
Oh.
I just remember it that way, IHOP. So, like I said, this causes a right-to-left shunt, all this unoxygenated blood.
What's IHOP
stand for? IHOP, it stands for the interventricular septal defect, hypertrophy of the right ventricle, overriding aorta, and then pulmonary stenosis.
And it's just that easy.
And it's just that easy.
And now you at home can remember that entire sequence thanks to the acronym IHOP.
But I remember it.
Perfect.
So all this blood that is not oxygen rich is being sent through the aorta because it can't get through that pulmonic valve. And as a result, you're not getting enough oxygen to your body and you become cyanotic. So you don't have enough oxygen. You're hypoxic. You know, you don't have enough oxygen.
Okay.
As a result, what will this look like? Well, babies can have a bluish tint, especially around their mouth. They can actually look kind of blue because they're deprived of oxygen.
Right.
Which is one of the things Jimmy Kimmel mentioned. You may hear a murmur. A heart murmur is just the sound of blood moving through a valve, by the way.
Okay.
You're not.
The murmur is the sound.
Yeah. We're not supposed to hear the blood as it moves through the valve. We just kind of hear the valves opening and closing. If you can hear the blood move through the valve, it's called a murmur.
I always thought it was a hole in the heart.
No.
Okay, no. Bad job. Sorry.
You could have a hole in your heart, but that's not what it is. These babies might have difficulty doing things like breastfeeding, for instance, because they tire out really easily while they're doing it. So they might turn blue or even pass out. They can have these things they call tet spells, where they do exactly that. They might cry, or even when they're having a bowel movement, they might turn blue and pass out.
Tetralogy, spells.
Tet,
I got it.
Yeah. It can also cause something called clubbing. It's not just seen in this particular disorder. Anything that results in hypoxia, so a lot of lung diseases, or lack of oxygen, can result in clubbing, which is this bulbous enlargement of the fingertips. That's pretty, I mean, you would notice right away. That's a really old sign, by the way. It's maybe the oldest sign in medicine.
Wow, really?
They used to be called Hippocratic fingers, because Hippocrates talked about them, too. Huh. They're not just in Tetralogy of Fallot, but that is one thing you can see them in. So like I said, the whole thing has to do with early on in development, the separation between the aorta and the pulmonary vessel do not form in the right place. All of this leads to, like I said, the enlarged right ventricle that isn't pumping, or that's trying to pump through this tight vessel. Mm-hmm. And it can be related to certain genetic mutations. There are certain syndromes. DeGeorge syndrome is one. Down syndrome can be related to this. If mom gets rubella while she's pregnant, this can cause Tetralogy of Fallot.
Would Tetralogy of Fallot cause those things, or would they be an offshoot of those?
They would things? Be. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Okay. So if you have somebody who has Down syndrome or DeGeorge syndrome, or mom had congenital rubella, advanced maternal age, or drug or alcohol abuse, any of these things, you have a higher likelihood of Tetralogy of Fallot. And then sometimes you just see
it. Just happens.
Yeah. As complex as all of this sounds, because it does, we have known about Tetralogy of Fallot for over 300 years. We figured this out a long time ago.
Wow.
In 1673, the Danish anatomist Steno wrote the first description of Tetralogy of Fallot. It was obviously based on an autopsy, and he noted all of the abnormal findings, and he basically said, I wouldn't even attempt to tell you why this happened. Which
Listen, you're going to hear a lot of people around my time period try to feed you a load of bull crap that they know what's happening, and I'm here to tell you, listen, his story ends of the future. You are not going to look back and laugh at me, not at Steno.
I'm just telling you.
I'm telling you, I don't know.
Flat out. I got no clue what's going on here. But he did say this. The baby was noted to have what is called a hair lip, what was colloquially called a hair lip.
What's the technical term for that?
Like a cleft.
Oh, cleft palate?
A cleft lip.
Cleft lip, okay.
But the baby was noted to have what they were calling a hair lip. And the mom had said, I think this is probably because I was really craving rabbit stew while I was pregnant and I ate a lot of it.
Mm.
And Steno was like, now that sounds dead on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely that's why that happened.
And this is why I'm not guessing about what is actually causing it.
And this idea, just on a side note, and I think we may have mentioned this briefly before, but this particular idea that things that mom did, saw, encountered, thought about, emotions that the pregnant person had during the pregnancy would have these kinds of effects on the baby. This was widespread, and even some of the, you know, way ahead of their time luminaries of, you know, congenital heart defects and then other congenital issues kind of had this concept.
It's that extremely pervasive idea even in modern age, right? Like you hear about women being told they shouldn't go see scary movies,
mm-hmm.
like why they're pregnant, because they, you know, could have an effect on the baby.
Exactly.
Or frightening and, things, I should say.
Yeah, and well, and this is, that's exactly what they used to tell women, is that, you know, if you're distressed in any way, if you're put in any undue emotional or physical stress, it's like hearing about something upsetting, reading a very thrilling book. You shouldn't read anything too exciting or thrilling. Don't see a scary movie. Don't even think sad thoughts. Pregnant people were advised to basically like stay positive, stay away from anything intense, just be really cheerful all the time.
No problem. Rest a lot.
And if you, except for housework, which is always great exercise for pregnancy. So pregnant people were advised to do lots of housework.
Yeah.
That's very convenient.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the work that's best for you, we found.
Yeah, just
doing the dishes and sweeping the floor.
Mm-hmm.
In 1777, Dr. Sandifort wrote a case report of what he called a blue boy who had what he described as sinking spells. and upon autopsy was found to have these similar findings that we've already talked about, the tetralogy findings. Mm-hmm. And shortly after that, there was a Dr. Hunter who wrote of a case of a boy who lived to the age of 13 with the same defect. He had the same sorts of spells, these what they would call sinking spells, basically just passing out, just mm-hmm. becoming hypoxic and passing out, especially with exertion, so doing something stressful or demanding. But he also seemed to have some growth issues as well. And he even, Dr. Hunter even theorized that maybe the lack of pulmonary blood flow, this tight pulmonic valve, maybe this has something to do with it, and why you don't have proper growth and stuff. It was way ahead of its time, the idea that this has anything to do with anything. I mean, he proposing this, right now this seems really obvious, but proposing this at the time was kind of brilliant.
Yeah.
He also advised that while he, again, he didn't know what caused it or what to do about it at all, definitely don't do any of the popular cures of the day, like bleeding or purging or blistering or giving caustic agents or anything like that. So that was good.
That's good. He's on point. Good job, Dr. Hunter.
In general, in many of these cases, the patients didn't live very long lives. If they made it out of infanthood, we have a lot of these, you know, like children and teenagers, and that was about as long as anybody was expected to survive with this defect. And they were weak and sickly throughout their lives. They were not able to, you know, go to school or have a job or get married or have kids or any of those kinds of things. So what kind of advances did we start to make? So this story gets a little happier. In the 1850s, the stethoscope was still new and exciting, and Dr. Peacock used it to correlate various murmurs with different defects that caused them, including being able to recognize a murmur that was associated with tetralogy of Fallot.
And I bet people who had them then all had, like, cool moves that they did with them, like really getting showy with their stethoscopes.
Like swinging them around.
Oh, no problem. I can listen to your heart with my super hearing.
Like wrap it around her neck and swing it around like a hula hoop.
Yeah, exactly. Very cool. Very hip look.
I do that now. Is that good?
Yeah, that's excellent. That's a great way to inspire confidence in your patients.
That'll give me lots of friends. In the 1880s, we finally see the Dr. Fallot of renown, Dr. Fallot, who publishes his article where he has actually encountered numerous cases now of the tetralogy, and he writes up all these different studies and what happened to them and their clinical findings and upon autopsy and all this stuff. And he's the first one who dubs it the tetralogy, who actually says, like, if you find these four things, they go together, this is indicative of this disorder, we know what this is, it's called the tetralogy. And everybody was like, of Fallot, I guess.
Of Fallot. And he's like, well, I'm not crazy about it, but so this is my, just want to check my legacy. Okay, great. All
are
right,
you
good.
Kidding me? No way. He was like, yes.
Yeah, of course. Well, you took the words right out of my mouth.
Well, I mean, I don't mean to brag.
If you insist.
But I guess it kind of is my tetralogy.
Why not Fallot's tetralogy?
I don't know.
That's weird. That's usually the structure that you say, right?
But it sounds good, tetralogy of Fallot.
It has a good flow to it, for sure.
It's abbreviated well. I have TOF all through my documents. Abbreviated well as TOF, tetralogy of Fallot. In 1936, Maude Abbott, who was a famous Canadian physician, and which is really cool to talk about. Year 1936, Maude Abbott, who was female, was a famous Canadian physician, expert on congenital heart disease, who published the Atlas of Congenital Cardiac Disease, which was the Bible of congenital cardiac disease, recognized in its time as one of the finest works anybody'd put together. She actually ended up pursuing her course of study in pathology and studying congenital heart disease and going down this road because she was denied the other internships, the other paths in medicine she wanted to take. Because of her gender.
I guess that time, though, sexism worked out great for everybody. I guess this one goes to sexism, right? I guess it worked out pretty good that time.
Maybe some of us are just, we're just going to succeed no matter how hard try to hold us down.
Fair enough.
So in it were drawings, clinical descriptions, EKG findings, chest x-ray findings. The heart looks boot-like. on a chest x-ray if you have tetralogy of flow.
Oh, odd.
And pathology and all this together for tetralogy of flow. And this is really important because you think about we're still not at a time where we can do what we would do now, which is an echo, the echocardiogram, which is like an ultrasound of the heart, which can show us all this stuff. We weren't doing all that yet. So any way you could diagnose it was a pretty good idea.
Well, we diagnosed it, but I want to fix it, Sid.
Well, I'm not going to do anything. Other smart people who could do surgery are going to do something about it. But first, why don't we head to the billing department?
Let's go.
The medicines that escalate macabre for the mouth.
You were going to be a conduit for history as it fixed the tetralogy of
right.
flow.
Right. I'm going to tell you about this is the good part. So the beginning of this story actually starts with a successful surgery to fix something else, a different congenital heart defect called a patent ductus arteriosus that happened in 1938. Now, I love podcasting, but this is an episode where if this were a visual medium, it would be helpful. Mm-hmm. So there is something called the ductus arteriosus that you have when you are a fetus. It's a connection. It's a vessel that connects the aorta and the pulmonic vessel. And it is supposed to exist in the developing fetus.
Okay.
And then it goes away because we don't need it anymore in our adult life. The reason is because it's in the fetus, it's shunting blood back to the aorta and away from the pulmonary vessel because it doesn't need to pump blood through those fluid-filled, amniotic fluid-filled lungs.
Right.
But then after we're born, we need blood to be pumped through our no longer fluid-filled lungs.
Okay.
Correct. So this closes off itself. That's part of the process. It closes off, just becomes a ligament, a remnant that's left there. Now, this doesn't always happen. Sometimes things go wrong.
Sure.
And so sometimes this little connection between these two vessels is left open. It causes a machine-like murmur.
What's that mean?
Sounds like machinery.
Oh.
Like a grinding machinery-like
murmur,
if you hear it. Anyway, so surgeons were trying to figure out how can we close this thing? We need to know how to close this thing because it shouldn't still be open about a week after birth. At the latest it closes. It shouldn't be open after that. We need to figure out how to close it. So in 1938, they figured out how to just ligate it and close it. And this was a big success because we hadn't been doing surgeries on hearts, especially baby hearts. So this was, a huge deal. So because they fixed that, this inspired somebody. So this is Dr. Helen Taussig, who was working in the cardiology clinic at Johns Hopkins, who was a brilliant, maybe the most known pediatric cardiologist in history.
Hmm.
Definitely one of the most known. So she began to wonder about a lot of the children she was seeing in her clinic with congenital heart defects and whether there would be some surgery that might help them as well. Because it seemed like the only approach to this, it's got to be a surgical solution.
Yeah,
there has to be
right.
a surgery here,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
She also, by the way, had worked there for some time because she was denied a spot in the medical internship she wanted because they would only allow one woman on the house staff at any given time. And
wow.
she was beaten out for the spot by 2 points by
oh.
another woman. So anyway, she devoted her life to this cardiology clinic and to these children. And it was a wonderful thing that she did because she started to ask the question, if we can close a ductus, that little connecting vessel in the heart,
sure.
if we can close it, could we not build one?
Construct. Okay.
Could we not construct a duct? We can close a duct. Could we not construct a duct?
Construct a duct is more fun to say. Certainly, we should be able to.
She actually went to Dr. Gross, who was the doctor who had done this procedure in 1938, the surgeon who had done it. She went to him and said,
"It's just an unfortunate name for a doctor."
Dr. Gross.
Dr. Gross is rough. That's a rough one.
She went to Dr. Gross.
And he was a surgeon?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Oh, Dr. Gross. My heart goes out to you, my friend. That's a tough putt.
She went to Dr. Gross, who had just done this successful procedure, and said, hey.
You got to work really clean. That's the thing. If people come into the operating table and they're like, oh, man, there's guts everywhere, they're going to be like, not just the name. And you'd be like, I get it. I've heard it my entire life. Okay, I'm a messy guy. It has nothing to do with my name. I'm just saying you got to work really clean.
That's true.
I'm done talking about Dr. Gross.
Dr. Gross, you're done with his name.
Yeah.
Well,
hi, I'll be looking in your nose today. My name is Dr. Boogers. I'll be your ENT.
You're not going to be done because she went to Dr. Gross and said, hey, you figured out how to do this, and that's amazing. Do you think you could do the opposite? Do you think you could build a duct? And he said, yeah, definitely. Like, for sure. No problem. I could. I'm not going to. Not really feeling that right now. Everybody's super excited about how I closed that other duct. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where the heat is. I'm not feeling.
Sure.
I'm not picking up what you're putting down.
Right. There's no heat behind making ducts.
So he said no. So she went back to Johns Hopkins and she bided her time because she knew that another surgeon, Dr. Alfred Blaylock, along with his assistant Vivian Thomas, were coming to work there, and she thought, this is a guy that I'm going to talk into the surgery because I know this surgery means, I know this is going to mean something. So she told him all of her observations on congenital heart defects and what she'd seen and why she thinks that this might work. So this was her theory on constructing a duct.
Okay.
She noticed that the worst symptoms started about a week after birth. Mm-hmm. When that thing I told you about, that ductus arteriosus, typically had closed. So what she was thinking was that was allowing some of the blood to go back. Here, all this blood is being shunted to the body and not making it through the lungs. Mm. This open little tunnel was like a back channel. It was allowing blood to go back through the lungs.
Yeah. I understand. Yeah.
So if it stayed open, maybe we could keep allowing blood to go back through the lungs.
Unless
you get more oxygen in the blood and you get more better. Oxygenated people.
Right. Good. I mean, you can Which stop at good. More oxygen in the blood. Right. That's the goal here.
Which is good. This wouldn't fix the problem, but kind of palliate the problem somewhat. So make things better.
Thank you.
Yeah. So she you know, pulled all this together and presented him with all this information. And he said, you know what? This sounds reasonable. I'm going to have to test out your theory for a while. So he attempted it a lot on some animal models. We won't go into detail there.
Thank you.
Yeah. And after 2 years, he decided, you know what? I think I can do this surgery. If you think this surgery can work, let's go for it.
All right.
So in 1944, they started doing the procedure to connect the subclavian artery, which arises from the aorta, to the pulmonary artery. So not exactly replicating the natural ductus arteriosus, but inspired by a similar concept. So they started doing these procedures, and they worked. So imagine with me, if you will, the moment. It's 1947, and these two doctors, Dr. Blaylock and Dr. Tosig, are giving a lecture in the big giant hall at the British Medical Association in London. And they're talking about the procedure, and they're showing diagrams, and they're going through the intricacies of the surgery and how, like, with each procedure, they altered it just a little to make it a little better and why the results got better with each one and all this stuff. They're telling the story. And then at the climax of the story, a spotlight appears on this gorgeous little 2.5-year-old, curly hair, pink cheeks, looks healthy as can be. And they said, and here is a surgery we did last week. Mm. And here stands this healthy baby girl that, you know, would never have been this healthy to just be here with us today. And a week ago, we did the surgery on her.
Sense of drama is so important when you're presenting this stuff. If you're going to get people hyped up. That's very good.
I don't usually.
Did they fly her in from like the, put her on wires and just like fly her in? Shoot some sparklers off, stuff like that.
She actually, in one of the articles I read, was described as cherubic.
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 That's adorable.
So the kids did oxygenate better. They had less, less problems with turning blue and passing out and all that. And they could play. And this sounds like a dumb thing to say, but these families had kids who could go play again, who could run around outside, who could play games, who weren't stuck on the couch all day. And the medical community just was on fire. So,
and that's before TV. So it really was sad back then, if you think about it.
So by the 1950s.
I can understand why you're getting teary eyed because, like, and what did they watch?
Their kids could play.
And not sit on the couch and not watch any TV.
Some of these kids were like 11 years old. And for the first time in their life, they're able to run around and play.
11 years of not watching TV. I mean, can you think about it?
So by the 1950s. Different procedures were tried, and there actually were some open heart procedures done. You know, it took us a while to get to the point. Obviously, anesthesia was a big part of this, too, to get to the point where we could open people up and fix problems.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, more for longer periods of time, more advanced problems. And they eventually figured out how to repair the defects, closing the hole and opening up the pulmonary vessel and reducing the size of that right ventricle and all that kind of stuff. And throughout the 70s, procedures became better. And of course, when, as I already alluded to, once we had the echocardiogram where we could ultrasound and look at the heart ahead of time, we didn't have to guess about what we were getting into. We could, you know, non-invasively know exactly what the structure of the heart was, mm-hmm. which was obviously a big advantage. And we can do that in utero, right?
Yeah.
We can see that in utero.
Mm-hmm.
While a patient is still pregnant, we can look in at the developing fetus and look for heart defects.
Sure, yeah.
So now we do surgery. We don't typically do that shunt that I described, the Blaylock-Taussig-Blaylock shunt. I forget which direction it's in. Anyway, the shunt that's named for them. We don't typically do that. You can still do procedures like that. Shunts sometimes are still done if in certain patients where the defect is so severe that you kind of have to do it stepwise, you need to do something immediately to help get oxygen into the blood and stabilize the patient. And then down the road, you'll do the complete fixing of it, to complete corrective surgery. Mm-hmm. But most people now end up sooner or later getting the complete corrective surgery, usually within the first year of life. There are patients as recently as the 90s who got it later than that, but usually within the first year of life. And it, like I said, it could be one surgery, it could be a series of surgeries, depending on exactly what type of, you know, the defect isn't exactly uniform in every single person.
Of course, yeah.
It's a little different. Untreated. Tetralogy of Fallot used to have a 35% mortality rate in the first year of life and 50% mortality rate in the first 3 years of life.
Ugh.
And as I already mentioned, most people were not living out of their teens, in the majority of people. Now, early mortality is less than 5%. People can live long, healthy lives. They do need monitoring, and sometimes other complications down the road can occur. But a lot of patients have the surgery, have, you know, everything corrected and never have problems from it. As an example, Sean White, the snowboarder, had tetralogy of Fallot repaired.
America's favorite only snowboarder.
It's really fascinating. I read the paper by Helen Taussig where she was kind of describing, like, well, one of many. I mean, obviously, they wrote about this a lot. You know, if you develop this procedure, you're going to write about a lot. But in one of her kind of going back and thinking about her whole course of everything, how she started there and working at the cardiology clinic and figuring out the surgery and everything. And she was talking about that they went back to see, like, how many of their patients down the road, how long did they live? Did they have other problems? But also, did they get a job? Did they get to finish school? Did they get married? Did they have kids? And talking about the, like, 300 and some children that resulted from all these lives that were able to be lived, you know, as a result. And it was, I mean, it's amazing to read about because they just kind of said, hey, I think this will work, and tried it out, and it did. She also mentioned specifically towards the end of the paper, she says, to the best of my knowledge, no patient was ever refused because he could not pay. Further, the hospital established the policy that no quote unquote cyanotic patient. So somebody comes in blue, no cyanotic patient who arrived at the doors of the hospital seeking help should leave without seeing me. So you were never turned away, and it didn't matter if you could pay. And she also said this study indicates that a handicap in childhood does not preclude success in adult life. On the contrary, a handicap may act as a stimulus to do one's best, which I thought was really, really inspiring way to look at it.
Well, I'm glad that we got that was harrowing. I would describe that as harrowing.
That was harrowing?
I would say that was harrowing. It was very daunting and a little upsetting at the beginning, and then things got better towards the end. So thank you. And that's great storytelling. And history, apparently, and so rarely works in that fashion.
It wasn't me. Thank these brilliant physicians who came up with it. And especially, it's nice to hear a story like this set in the time period where so many female physicians play a role.
Yeah, absolutely.
A big role. And, you know, it, the amazing thing is this isn't something that has to devastate families anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to, because we can fix it. And I don't understand a world that would deny anybody this life-saving procedure, no matter what the cost, ever.
Folks, thank you so much for listening to our show. We hope you have enjoyed it. If you did, please leave us a rating or review on iTunes, or, you know, just tweet about the show. Say, hey, listen to the show. You know that thing you heard about on Jimmy Fallon? Jimmy Kimmel?
So, yeah.
Why do we have two Jimmys? On Jimmy Kimmel, here's more information about it. It's got a fascinating history. And
say the name of our show, Sawbones.
Sawbones. The show. And then my name, and then Sydney's name after it.
You can just leave mine off. Justin's the real star.
Shut up. Thank you to taxpayers for letting us use their song Medicines as the intro and outro on our program. Thank you to the Maximum Fun Network for having us as part of their extended podcasting family. And folks, that is going to do it for us. Actually, no, wait. You know what? We have a P.O. box where people send us stuff sometimes. P.O. Box 54, Huntington, West Virginia, 25706. And I wanted to say thank you so much to Christina for the lovely book that is currently sitting on our coffee table.
Oh, that's a great book.
And Cecil sent us a scarf that they made. And Cecil knitted us some snakes, like in our logo. They're awesome.
They're adorable. And Charlie loved the scarf.
That is going to do it for us, folks. So until next week, my name is Justin McElroy.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
And as always, don't drill a hole in your head.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.